Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
From Sugar 23, I'm Angela Ledgerwood, and this is Lit Up. This week we have a very special episode because I have my friend and colleague Liam Billingham on the pod. He also produces Lit Up. He's been on here before. And back by popular demand, he is here.
Popular demand.
It's truly.
Everyone's been clamoring to have me back.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, thank you.
Liam is in LA and I am in New York, and we often... So Liam is often the silent person on all of the Lit Up interviews, but he is a huge part of this show, and he has a big job doing other things too. So he is the senior producer of podcasts at Sugar 23, where we both work. He's also the host of several podcasts, but the one that's kind of hit the charts at the moment is called Die Hard on a Blank. And Liam, give us in a nutshell, what is it about? Someone may have listened to the episode we shared recently.
Well, first of all, thank you. My favorite part of my job is producing Lit Up, and that's a true story. But Die Hard on a Blank is a podcast that explores the influence of Die Hard on action movie cinema, one action movie at a time. So basically, Die Hard comes out, it has a huge impact on action movies. It changes the game. Gone is necessarily the muscle-bound Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger's of the world, and it is like a regular guy who's just in LA to visit his wife when terrorists take over a building. And it was so successful and quite frankly so critically loved and is considered by many people to be the greatest action movie of all time, and it spawned a subsequent genre of blight, basically what's known as Die Hard on a Blank. So the best example would be Speed is Die Hard on a Bus, or Cliffhanger is Die Hard on a Mountain. So there's, like, according to my co-host Phil's count, 170 movies with the admittedly loose definition that this could be Die Hard on a whatever the case might be. And we are going through and covering those one movie at a time. So by the time this comes out, our last episode would be on the film Striking Distance, which is a kind of like Die Hard and a serial killer thriller sort of movie. It stars Bruce Willis, which is partially why we decided to cover it. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the thesis statement of the show is that we take action movies very, very seriously and try to figure out what they're about, both in terms of the story and the themes, and also how they relate to Die Hard and the impact that Die Hard had on the genre of action movies.
So you can imagine that Liam and I come at entertainment from two very different vantage points. Liam's often like, have you watched that show? And I'm like, what are you talking about, Liam?
But that's true. But I also love books. I'm a big book guy. And this show has enriched I read more interesting books because I'm the producer on this podcast than I ever did before. So I have you to thank for that.
Well, my pleasure, my pleasure. So wait, you're also the executive producer on a pretty big podcast at the moment, Time Person of the Week as well. So, you know, Liam and I, before we record sessions with our guests, you know, have a gossip and catch up pretty much before or afterwards. So I hear everything that's going on. Sometimes I get to suggest guests for that podcast too. But
you're an invaluable resource because you know everybody. It's so great.
Thank you. Thank mm-hmm. you. Well, so we decided to do this episode as kind of an end of summer roundup to see, you know, I can share a little about what I've been reading and the themes I've been following, but also Liam is going to talk about what he's been watching, what he's also been reading. And we just thought we'd just capture how we usually kind of just catch up ourselves.
It's a gab session.
That's right.
It's a gab session.
That's it.
So that'll be fun.
I mean, who's going to start?
Angela, why don't you start? Because you have a big trip coming up, right?
Yes.
We're recording this. You're going to be on vacation when it comes out, I think, or maybe just back. And I know you are preparing to go on a trip and probably reading some literature connected to that trip. So why don't you tell me what you're reading?
I will. So I'm about to go to Cornwall, England, to go walking along the cliffside villages. And this is a vacation where everyone else is going to Greek islands or Nantucket, all these places to capture the end of summer. I have had to buy a new raincoat for my vacation because walking in England at this time of year probably means very chilly weather. Lots of wet socks and woolens, and I cannot wait.
That sounds amazing. That sounds amazing.
So a book that Anthony, my fiancé, gave me was a British book called The Bell by Iris Murdoch. And I haven't read any of her books, and she's written, I think, maybe 50. Mm-hmm. She's a prolific writer. And this one is set in the countryside of England, outside an abbey in a burgeoning, or I always get that word wrong, in a small community that's being established outside of a religious order. But what's going on inside the abbey is very private and mysterious. And there's a story about this place of a bell, the big church bell, falling into the river somehow. Huh. And on that very night, there was a murder or a death.
Whoa.
So they're kind of dredging this bell up, and a lot of things are going to happen. But what's so a signature of Iris Murdoch is kind of the latent sexuality that's written into nature. And we kind of get this sense of foreboding. She described almost like these leaves as spread eagled, you know, when we're talking about a young nun that's about to go into the abbey. So all along the way, you're trying to work out who's going to end up having a, you know, frolic with whom, at some point in the book, or what transgressions will happen. So it's quite heightened and really interesting. So
have you ever seen the movie Picnic at Hanging Rock from Australia, the Peter Weir movie?
Liam, what a question. Of course.
I figured you had, but it makes me think of that, the kind of like a mystery at, well, it's a girls' school, right? But yeah, the like kind of like yearning as existential dread kind of thing. That sounds very much like Picnic at Hanging Rock. Of course you've seen that movie.
Oh, and that movie, if anyone hasn't seen it, has inspired so much Aussie fashion. You know, there's always kind of a Picnic at Hanging Rock moment in a Zimmerman, you know, story or things like that. And it may have been adapted from a book. I ought to know that.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, we can find that out. What's the name of the Iris Murdoch book again for folks listening if they want to read it?
Sure. It's called The Bell.
The Bell. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. The Bell from 1958. I'm going to read this. It sounds great.
Have you started it? She's a master at character studies.
Mm.
Sometimes I find, you know, in books these days, it's a bit like Charles Dickens or, you know, Jane Austen. You can read just one paragraph introducing a character and you hear about the twitch of their mustache or the shape of their lip.
Mm.
And you already know what kind of person they're trying to make you believe this character is.
It's like a gesture. It's like a gesture or something that defines the twirling of the mustache. Yeah, totally. I love that. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's what I'm reading to prepare for this trip. And I'll take it with me because I have to keep reading. And I'm going to take another book. That's why I mentioned Dickens, because Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver is based upon Dickens as David Copperfield, but it's set in the mountains of southern Appalachia. So it's taking a young boy, you know, who's a kid to a single mom and going into that story. But apparently he's such a character that you just fall in love with this kind of waify boy who has to survive. So they're going to be my vacation reads.
This is ridiculous, but when you say waify, I picture like Timothée Chalamet as the main character of this book, kind of like a tiny little boy. Picnic at Hanging Rock is a book. It was written in 1967, and the movie came out in 1975. And I've not seen it, but there was a TV version that came out a few years ago.
I'd like to read that and see it.
Yeah, I saw that movie like at a very young age, and I found it very, very troubling. Do you feel like this kind of fiction, the like existential, it's a kind of classic stuff, Iris Murdoch is like not, I feel like I don't read as much of it as I used to, but I wonder if that's me reading more nonfiction now as an adult than I used to.
I don't want to generalize, but I think a lot of men read a lot more nonfiction than necessarily women might. People will probably scream at me and say that's totally, you know, stereotypical. But I think maybe as adults, I find novels harder to get into sometimes, and that a nonfiction you can kind of pick up and put down a bit more easily.
Yeah, I think that's true. The stakes are lower. Like you're not as maybe not emotionally engaged, but like I just finished reading this book for the podcast called Last Action Heroes, which is about Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and it's a really entertaining read, but it's not a demanding read. So there, I definitely put it down. By the time this episode comes out, I think the author of that book will have been on Die Hard on a Blank, so I can just say I'm reading it because he's going to be a guest on the show. And I put it down for a couple weeks because I wanted it to be fresher for when we record with him, and I didn't feel like I had to start the book over again, if that makes sense. I was able to jump in like chapter 4 or whatever the case might have been.
No, I think a novel is so well read. If you have hours and hours to really dive in, I find if I put, you know, right now I'm reading a manuscript and I've given it a few days off, and sometimes you can just forget about a novel and go, do I even want to go back in? Maybe it's sometimes easier to leave the thread, but maybe the best books, you just have to keep going.
Well, I'm also curious because you read for like a living, right? Part of your job is to read books, and like, because you have to think about reading a manuscript and thinking about, like, is this a book I'd want to publish or get involved with? Or I have to interview an author. Like, is reading sometimes more of a chore? And by extension, is the fact that you get to read Iris Murdoch on holiday, like, such a relief?
Yes. The relief of just picking a novel from a deceased author you know you couldn't even try to interview is a relief. Mm-hmm. I also think it's great to read books that have stood the test of time. So time curates for you in a way. So there's, and I think Anthony bought this book because it was a bookstore recommendation. And they're so powerful, you know, that wall of books with a real name next to them saying, this is why I love this book. That really helped. I mean, just going back to, you know, reading for a living, and I'm sure it's the same with watching film, which I want to ask you about. It's almost like you just know it when you read it, and that becomes the joy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if you ever stop watching movies, but I stop reading proposals or I stop reading books if I just know it's not appropriate for our imprint or whatever the purpose might be. But then when there's that spark of reading something that you know is alive and could be really important, that's the most exciting part of my job.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, so many things came up there. Like, so one of the highlights of my summer was going to New York City and spending 2 weeks there and seeing you in person, which we hadn't done in a while because you're in New York and I'm in LA. And going, because I lived there for so long, to couple of my favorite bookstores, which were the Center for Fiction in downtown Brooklyn. I also made it to, I went to a couple other bookstores, but I used to, when I worked in downtown Brooklyn, I used to go to the Center for Fiction like quite a lot. And it's extremely hard for me to not buy a book when I go into a bookstore. Like that's what you're supposed to do. But the going to the recommendation section and just being like, looking at everything that's there, it is really powerful. You're like, oh, you know, Henry, the bookseller, or the like, loves whatever book, and it really makes you want to read. And there's so much out there that I find myself teetering between. I want to read classic stuff. I have shelves and shelves and shelves of books that I've never read, but also I went to Vroman's this summer for a book reading by a writer named S.A. Crosby, who wrote a book called All the Sinners Bleed, which is like a Southern noir. And he was there and I chatted with him and he signed the book. And I was like, I have to, the author signed this book and handed it to me, you know? So it's like, I really want to read that, but I tend to not necessarily like look to new fiction. I tend to look backwards to fiction and look to new nonfiction to read. And as to your point of like, men reading more nonfiction, I will tell you this. My dad only read nonfiction. He didn't read fiction. And I, as a kid, loved... I kind of was like, oh, nonfiction, that's boring. And I asked him once, like, why do you read nonfiction? And his answer was like, I don't feel... Or why do you only read fiction? Excuse me. And his answer was like, I only have so much time and I only want to read things that really happened. Which is so interesting.
So that is nonfiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the world now. We're so pulled in so many directions and time is your most valuable, the most valuable thing you have to give to people or to hobbies or books. And for all of us, we decide what kind of experience we want. And that's what's so wonderful about books is that you can decide the next one is a nonfiction book about food, which leads me to another theme of many books I'm being drawn to. Nice.
Good transition. I loved it. I loved it. Oh, wait, can I interrupt one thing I forgot to say? As far as putting down, not finishing a book or not finishing a movie, I really struggle with not finishing things. Like, I was watching something this week. I will not name it. Well, I will. It's a movie from the 80s called Code of Silence, which is a sort of detective action movie that's set in Chicago. And it's a Chuck Norris movie, and everything about the movie is good except for Chuck Norris. He's not good in the movie. He's a terrible actor. And I was like, I might finish this because I don't generally watch movies in one sitting anymore because I am an overtired parent of two children, so I fall asleep. So it's rare for me not... The movie has to be pretty bad for me to not finish it because I try to enjoy everything. So yeah, and with books, I generally try to finish them. With TV shows, I will stop the second it doesn't work anymore because I just don't care.
Well, then I have another question for you. So how good is a movie that you will see it twice or more than twice?
How often does that
happen? Because I know you do that.
I do it. I don't do it much. I will. Okay. Well, I think you're speaking specifically about one movie, which I have seen twice this summer and I'm seeing for a third time next week. That film is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. No, it's Oppenheimer, the Christopher Nolan biopic meets atomic bomb film. You know, I have a really interesting relationship to his movies. Memento came out when I was 19 and blew my mind, and I've been ride or die ever since. Now, when I say ride or die, I don't mean like I think every movie that he makes is like a masterpiece and incredible. I mean it more that like I have half my life have been watching his movies and they fascinate me, and they sometimes kind of they're provocative sometimes, and I don't think everything works, but I'm drawn to them because I admire the ambition and the spectacle. And so in the case of Oppenheimer, I saw it opening night at the local multiplex here in Burbank in 70 millimeter. And I was like, that was good. But I also went at 9 o'clock and so it ended at midnight. And I already had bought tickets to see it at the City Walk in IMAX 70 millimeter with what's called the 15 perf, which is the way you're supposed to see it. It's the way he filmed it. And there's only 30 IMAXs in the entire country that can show it that way. And one of them is 10 minutes from my house, which is why I like to live in LA. So I went and saw it, and you've seen it, right?
Yes.
What did you think?
I thought it was fascinating, and I was riveted from the moment it started and revolted, and I thought it was really interesting how there wasn't this moral judgment that was placed on these characters, but obviously there was in many ways, but the light of hand that way. I enjoyed it very, very much.
Yeah, it's very adult in that way. And I will just tell you that if you're a film person, the difference between the movie, in the way that I saw it the first time and the second time, it is almost a different movie, because the IMAX 70 millimeter print is, I've never seen anything like it. Beyond whether like you like the movie or whatever, it is like, I mean, the IMAX in New York close to you is 11 stories tall. It is a massive screen meant for showing nature documentaries, and that's historically what IMAX is for. What Nolan has done is turned a character drama, which essentially this is. I mean, with the exception of the bomb sequence, which is amazing, you know, that's what you think would be an IMAX. But the movie throughout cuts between IMAX and standard view throughout. So there'll be a shot of Oppenheimer, and then it will cut to the flashback of Robert Downey Jr., and Robert Downey Jr. will be massive. And so all of a sudden, it takes on this, scale and scope that is so emotional because of the size of the frame. And it might just be like Oppenheimer looking at the droplets of water or whatever the case might be. Like, it's truly a whole other movie in my point of view. And I, when it ended in the IMAX 70 millimeter, I was like, this is one of the most astonishing movie going experiences I've ever had. There's only really one person who can command the budget and the scope to do something. Well, that's not true. There's only one person to really choosing to do it this way. And so I was like, I have to go again. And there are people, Bill Gaiabiri, who's a friend of mine and a critic at Vulture, has seen the movie 7 times. Now, he's seen it 7 times because he's been writing about it all summer. But his point of view on it is you can only really see this movie the way it was meant to be seen for the period of time that it's in the IMAX thing. And so it's kind of like the joke with my wife is she's like, how many times are you going to see Oppenheimer? And I'm like, well, it's kind of like my Eras tour. So if you're going to Taylor Swift, I'm going to see this movie multiple times, because it's at a time when so much of movie culture is like small screen and people are like whatever watching on their phones. The fact that I have to carve out 3 hours of the day, usually when my kids are in school, and like go sit in a movie theater and have this experience is like the closest I get to like church. I am not a church going person, but the scope of it is just like incredible. And it really feels like a different movie than it just does in a standard format.
I have to go. I maybe haven't been reading enough reviews about it that stress that point, that there's a way to see this in the cinema.
Yeah, and I'm just a little obsessive about his work. You know, even I really like it. I read this book about him called The Nolan Variations in the lead up to this. I rewatched some stuff. Like, I really invested time in, because I kind of expected this movie to either be like his triumph, or in some ways I was like, if this doesn't work, like, man, like, this is a big, big project, you know, that gives him a different kind of potential legitimacy in terms of how he's viewed. And look, Christopher Nolan doesn't need to be loved. But so I was really excited, and I thought it was very good the first time. And the second time I was like, is this the best movie he's ever made? It's not my favorite, but it might be the best movie he's, it's certainly like a 5-star achievement, and really works better as a film the second time.
Can you rattle off some of his other movies for people to put this in context in case they
I think I can probably rattle off all of them. So Memento, Insomnia, Batman Begins, The Prestige, the magician movie with Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale, The Dark Knight, Inception, The Dark Knight Rises, Interstellar, Tenet, which is a movie I love and nobody appreciates, but I think is amazing. And Oppenheimer. I don't think I forgot one in there. I'm not like necessarily a guy who can rattle off everyone's filmography.
Did he do Gallipoli? Or not Gallipoli?
No, that's Peter Weir. That was Peter Weir.
The war one, the other one.
Oh, Dunkirk. Yes, I forgot Dunkirk, which is also
I got the chink great movie. In your armor.
You did. And that's funny because that's the one I chose to, that's one of the ones I chose to rewatch to prep for this, because they have some thematic and not even thematic, I suppose, but they both take place during World War II. So that was one that I definitely chose to revisit and is a very, very good movie. But yeah, this is kind of like his most experimental tendencies as a storyteller mixed with like this classic big theme of World War II and the bomb and quote unquote great men of history. And to your point, I don't think the movie considers Oppenheimer a quote great man of history. It's just kind of one way to describe what the movie is doing. Yeah. And I thought it was a real achievement, and the platonic ideal of a movie going experience in 2023. Like, I have two movie going experiences. One is I go by myself to these big epics or these movies I want to see. And the other is, like, last week I took my daughter to see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was a blast, but it's a very, very different movie going experience than going to the IMAX by myself on a Friday morning.
I remember hugely being impacted by the Teenage Mutant Ninja movies when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hugely important.
I'd love to go back. I just remember Splinter.
They hold up really well. I love that original 1990. It's dark and weird. She enjoyed the new one. She kept talking about how cute the Ninja Turtles were when they were babies, which is about her speed right now. She likes cute little... She's like, oh, they're so cute. And Splinter's pretty cute in this. And Splinter is voiced by Jackie Chan, which is really nice. It's cool to hear him. So yeah,
because
anyway.
I remember them being in the sewer system and Splinter. That was really dark,
mm-hmm.
what they were mm-hmm. up against, which so many films of that era, New York City was a dark place, I guess. You know, it was not the city we live in that we feel is pretty safe and clean, even though that's kind of gone backwards a bit in the last few years.
I don't know. When I was there, it felt like the same place. I mean, I haven't, but when, you know, I left in 2019, and being there in 2023, I was like, this largely feels like the same place to me, but I don't live there day in, day out, you know? But yeah, it is a dark, they're dark movies. I would not show my 5-year-old daughter the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for a couple more years. I was 7 when I saw it, because I remember seeing it in the movie theater, or 8. So
yeah, I think I would have been about maybe 9 or 10 then.
Movies were darker. Kids' movies were darker then, and in some ways, I think, more interesting. I'm a big proponent of showing my daughter things that are like a little scary, like a little outside of her comfort zone, because I think I was shown stuff like that as a kid, and I think it sort of got me interested in art in a way that maybe I wouldn't if I was just... So much of kids' TVs now, I know we're off track here, this is dad stuff, but so much of kids' TV now is like disposable crap that when I have a chance to show her something like The Wizard of Oz or a Miyazaki movie, I'm like, this is what I want you to be seeing because you watch Netflix cartoons the rest of the time.
I'm just now that we're on TV, I was just thinking when I grew up in Australia, I would be the kid on Sunday afternoons watching the like classic movies, you know, like the Elvis ones with, oh, who's the fabulous actress? I love Gidget. Sally Field.
Sally Field.
When she was Gidget. And then there was like Gidget meets Elvis. All the old classic movies that were so PG, but yet still adult themed.
There was no PG-13 then. You couldn't. There was only PG and R. So it was like it wasn't until like 1984 or 5 or something like that they were like, we need a new intermediate rating. Yeah, I miss just linear TV showing stuff that was inappropriate for me to watch, but I watched it anyway as a kid.
The only thing I got really spooked by was seeing Silence of the Lambs at a birthday party.
What? How old were you?
I can't. I've blocked it out. I think I'm maybe 10, you know, at a sleepover. And it was terrifying. And I had to recover for a week of nightmares. God. And, you know, it then meant that my mother had to call up the mother who'd hosted the party, my friend's mom. It was a whole thing.
Drama. Yeah. I was really scared, speaking of topical, William Friedkin, the great film director who just passed away. I saw The Exorcist at far too young of an age, and that movie really, like, it still upsets me as a very, 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 very lapsed Catholic. I still have this, like, devil fear kind of thing, and that movie just I mean maybe now it's like as an older person it's just seeing a child in danger is what upsets me about it. Maybe it's not the spooky stuff, but making a sweet girl the literal Antichrist is like pretty powerful still.
I can't remember when I saw that, but it was definitely not when it was terrifying or impactful in that way.
We went on a long tangent and you were supposed to talk about food. Which is fine. I'm glad we did it, but that's I want to get back to your food inspired books and what you've been thinking about.
I'm always now thinking about food always, and I'm learning a lot more about wine because my partner and I are growing grapes to make our own wine, and we just bottled last week. The wine that we harvested from last year, which was our first year doing this.
Congratulations. That feels like a very big deal.
It is a huge deal. And it was such fun. So I was like on the factory line, essentially. So it's quite an extraordinary.
Lucy, I Love Lucy, crushing the grapes with your feet. I just, that's
sort of
the image.
We did that. But amazing. That was last year, this time last year. So it'll be harvest time soon, usually sometime in September, could be as late as October, but it all kind of is weather dependent. So because of that, I'm reading a book that came out a few years ago, and it's called Cork Dork by Bianca Bosca. And
it
was
a
you know, New York Times bestseller. And I'll just read you the subtitle because it gives you a sense. A wine-fueled adventure among the obsessive sommeliers, big bottle hunters, and rogue scientists who taught me to live for taste. So she was a tech reporter and decided to kind of immerse herself in the world of sommeliers. Now, that is a word I can never say correctly.
I can't say it. I'm not even going to try.
I'm still butchering it. So please forgive me. I get
sommelier? Is it sommelier? I'm trying.
Sommelier. She actually, in the beginning of the book, she gives you, you know, the phonetic way to say it. So I'm just trying to look it up for everyone. But even then, I find, oh, here we go. Sommelier. Sommelier.
That's kind of what I, is that what it's, sommelier? Woof, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I always do this little Ellie in there, you, but it's
you need to learn sommelier. To say it if you're doing wine stuff, if you're selling wine,
I really, really do.
How many bottles of wine have you bottled?
Oh my gosh, so it will have been about 500 cases. So everyone on this podcast is going to hear once it's ready to sell and get out to the world, I will be peddling our wine. But it's really, really good.
It's a rosé, right?
So we have a couple. We have a sparkling Pet Nat, which is a natural sparkling that's made from Merlot grapes. So it's this gorgeous pale pink, kind of cloudy pale pink because it's unfiltered. All the fermentation and everything kind of happens. A lot happens in the bottle. With champagne, they disgorge it, which means they let some out and add more sugars. But with a Pet Nat, it's natural kind of the process. So that we have that. We grow Cab Franc and Merlot grapes. So we have a Merlot, a Cab Franc, and then a Carbonic Merlot, which is kind of a cool experimental way to, again, just see what happens with the grapes if you leave them to kind of bubble and infuse and do their stuff in a different way.
You're kind of a scientist. It's like so scientific, right?
Oh, it's brilliant. And, you know, we have a winemaker, and I say that, you know, the winemaker that is kind enough to lend us his expertise as his side project is a guy called is a great man called Byron Elmendorf, and he's the winemaker at Macari Vineyards on the North Fork, and he just got named, you know, best winemaker on the North Fork, which is very exciting. So he, you know, has a real point of view. We have a point of view about the kind of wines we like, and then we do it together. But Byron is the one who is the man in the science lab almost, or making these decisions about when is the right time to move wine from one, you know, vessel to the other, when it's time to bottle, all this really, really cool stuff.
That is really cool.
So that has completely influenced my reading.
Do you think you just walk around thinking about wine a lot now? Is that like a thing for you?
The thing is, because I'm pregnant, I cannot drink or taste the wine very much. I did have
spoiler alert for the podcast. You didn't.
I did have some sips to taste, but you know, I cannot enjoy wine with abandon at the moment, but
understandable.
That will change.
That's both understandable and very responsible of you as a person who's going to have a baby. Congratulations, by the way. I knew this before, but I'll just say it officially on the air.
Thank you.
So is Anthony doing the tasting for you? Is he really stepping up?
Of course, yeah. And I had to tell him, because you're really on a factory line and it's really fast. Like once these things get started, you know, the wine's coming into the bottles, into these machines, the corks are happening, then they get labeled and then they come out and you pack them straight into boxes. And it can get quite overwhelming if one part of this chain messes up. And, you know, the whole crew of guys, they happen to be guys, although many, you know, there are many women in the industry, but they all drink some of the wine before they get started, you know, even if it's 9 a.m., just to taste what's really going in the bottle. So I had to say, hey, watch out.
Yeah, I feel like if I worked in like wine, beer, or one of these industries, like, you know, you see these guys who are brewers at their cool breweries and they're drinking beer at 9 a.m. because it's like a professional kind of interest. And like I barely drink beer or wine anymore because I get very sleepy when I drink it. But I just can't imagine having like a alcoholic beverage before 5 o'clock anymore. Cause I just like, if I have a drink at 1 at like 3 o'clock, I'm like, you know, when you have a kid and you go to birthday parties, you'll find that there are some parents that are like sparkling seltzers at the kids' birthday parties. And then there are the cool ones who are like, there's beer in the other cooler, wine in the other cooler. And you're like, yeah, like we're doing it. And you have one beer and then you get home from the party at 3:15 and you're like... Like, I've literally just come home and fallen asleep after, like, a two-beer birthday party or something like that. It happens.
I think you have to work up your daytime tolerance.
I do. I have no daytime tolerance. But you know what? I'm 40. It's okay not to have daytime tolerance is my feeling on that, at least. But also, I fall asleep at night very early, so I don't have a window of tolerance anymore at all.
Well, then, that's a question. How and when do you find time to read if you're a sleepy parent?
Well, so I will say that I think my reading has decreased a lot. You know, part of the problem is the phone being accessible and looking at articles that I half read on my phone. But what I've started to do, you know, I have an 8-month-old who finally is a pretty good sleeper. So he's in bed by 6:30, 7 these days, and my daughter's asleep by 8:15, and that hasn't always been true because of the challenges of this. So often I will get into bed at like 10 and read, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes or till I start to fall asleep. And that really is so much better than, I don't even bring my phone into the bedroom anymore. I have two alarm clocks in the form of children running into my room or screeching from the next room over. So that is definitely my reading time. Though I will say I'm reading this Last Action Heroes book for the podcast, and when this will publish a few weeks later, but we're recording this on the Thursday after we got hit by a tropical storm Hillary, which was Sunday, and was at least where we are only ended up being rain. We didn't get any wind, but we were homebound for the whole day, and my son still naps. My daughter doesn't. She's 5, he's 8 months. So we would put him down, and if we were lucky enough, and she would distract herself. She's an oldest child, so she has a tendency to like want our attention all the time because she's used to it. She's had it for a long time. So if we could get her either into a groove of playing something she wanted to play, or if we had to be like, you want to watch one episode of TV, we would read our books. And so I read for a huge chunk of the day on Sunday. And I just have to say that like, a lazy Sunday of reading is so rare for me now and so pleasurable that, like, it was really nice to read. I think I read 200 pages on Sunday. And also, it's nice to be in a book that you're just devouring, right? You know, speaking of, like, sometimes literature, it can be hard to be, like, you know, especially if it's thoughtful and interesting, like I imagine The Bell by Iris Murdoch is, it can be hard to really dig in and just get totally absorbed. And with this kind of like light, really enjoyable nonfiction, Last Action Heroes, I just was destroying the book. I mean, I just was reading, and just like so enjoyable and so pleasurable to just have a book that feels good to read. Like reading that feels good, which is a big thing of this podcast, is what lights me up. And I don't do it enough.
I also think it's so good for our brains to have that prolonged concentration, but mixed with pleasure.
It doesn't happen enough in life anymore, you know?
Yeah. It's like a snow day, you know, and all of a sudden you're homebound and you think, oh, well, what do I do? And to decide not to watch television, I can't watch TV in the day. It just really gives me the creeps. So
me too. Why is that?
And I'd rather really read anyway, but...
Why is it so depressing to watch TV during the day?
I think it... Or, I mean, to me, it just says that there's kind of been a breakdown in...
organization?
Routine or... Although there is nothing better than watching a movie on a Sunday afternoon, as I said, when it's snowing or... You know, but I think
I will. I don't like you know, my daughter when she's home from school earlier, she'll be like, "Can I watch TV in the middle of the afternoon?" And like, of course, we'll let her if we have to work or whatever. But we're not like especially workday TV people. Like, we don't, except for like if something extraordinary is happening in the world and the TV's on. But like, you know, usually we're just working all day, and I will occasionally have YouTube on in the background or whatever. But I will say that the two times I really enjoy watching things that's not the evening time is sometimes if my daughter and my wife are out of the house in the middle of the day on a Saturday and the baby's napping, I will be like, this is my chance to watch that like 90-minute gritty independent movie that I've wanted to see. Or like, and well, I will have be able to concentrate. Right. Yeah,
film
totally.
Is...
It's important. And Sunday afternoon movie time where we make popcorn and we get my daughter to actually commit to a night. Like Wizard of Oz, she like kind of blew her mind. You know, those kinds of experiences are nice. But I'm pretty anti like TV on a Tuesday afternoon makes me sad. I don't know why. Yeah. Maybe it's because like daytime TV, which I don't really watch. But like the whole idea of that is like if you watch daytime TV in the middle of the day in America.
It just feels like you've let something go in a way.
Yeah.
Eesh.
You could be using the day more productively.
Yeah. When I grew up, like what was on in the day was like the Ricky Lake, then the Donahue, then the Oprah.
Yeah. The sort of self-help
I watched
weirdness.
A lot
yeah.
of TV as a kid.
Did you have The Price is Right in Australia?
Of course.
Okay. I figured.
But we had our Aussie version.
Oh, really? Okay. What was it called?
Yeah.
Was
the
it The Price is Right?
Right.
Is Aussie?
Price
okay.
Is right.
Yeah. 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 So you didn't have Bob Barker. You had like Australian Bob Barker, whoever that happened
yeah.
to be.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was. Now, Liam, we have to wrap this up.
I know. Well, this is what happens, guys. This is why we just talk
about this.
This
is why we have
talk.
To put time limits because we could just yap and then we realize that we've not got to the work stuff. But
well, this is
there...
work stuff.
This is. But is there. Look, you also have such good TV and film recommendations. Can you just like give us a quick hit list of just some things that
sure.
are worth our time?
What have I been watching lately? Well, right now I think I'm between shows. I recently watched, and I should say this is a Sugar 23 client, but Steven Soderbergh's series Full Circle on HBO Max, which is a pretty amazing five or six episode series about a kidnapping of a boy, of a rich boy in Manhattan, but also the story of who kidnapped him. It is based on a Japanese film called High and Low from 1956, directed by Akira Kurosawa, which I only bring up because it is maybe one of my top five films of all time. It's an absolutely astonishing police procedural.
Would you recommend watching that film first?
No, I mean, I think what's interesting about that, what Soderbergh and his the writer Ed Solomon have chosen to do, High and Low was sort of about the have and have nots and the animosity between them in post-World War II Japan. And I think that this film is about that in a much more globalized sense. Now, that makes it sound like it's very serious, but it's pretty like, Steven Soderbergh has found a way to make frothy, entertaining genre films that also have a little undercurrent of reality in them. And this is just a good watch. And specifically the best thing I think about it is Claire Danes is always wonderful as like a neurotic New Yorker. She's sort of made a meal out of that between this and the Fleischman is in Trouble show that she did earlier this year. And an actress I love, Zazie Beetz, who has been in a million things but plays like a prickly post office inspector detective in this, and she's very quote-unquote unlikable, and she really commits to it. And it was kind of one of those things where I was like, I want the Columbo version of this. Like, I want this woman to do a week in week out detective show, which would be very different from Full Circle. I think that is definitely something lately to watch, and it's on Max, not HBO Max, but Max.
That sounds amazing, and I've been threatening to watch it, and I will. Okay,
it's
I have
it.
one book to share, and I will sign off. And the thing that's next up for me is a nonfiction book called National Dish, and it's by the well-known food writer Anya von Bremzen, and she explores six of the world's most fascinating and iconic culinary cultures. So she goes to
wow.
France, Italy, Japan, Spain, Mexico, and Turkey. So it's almost like if you were a foodie, it's like an eat, pray, love of examining these places and their foods and the stories around them. But she
mm-hmm.
is a really funny woman. She's from the Soviet Union and has a really amazing memoir called Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. And she's written a lot since the war with Ukraine to kind of bring context A, to their national dishes and support the people of the Ukraine. So I'm going to leave everyone with that. And I'm sure people are going to want you back again, maybe for a full episode.
This is a full episode. We talked for 50 minutes. No, this is as full as it gets.
For fall.
Oh, fall. I heard the full autumn. Episode. The autumn. Yeah, I'll come on and talk about flannels and my favorite sad dad music. That would be... But I live in Southern California, so like... Sadly seasonal. Maybe we should do that so you can tell me what's happening in New York, because I am a East Coast kid in a West
to
Coast.
To tell you about the cable knits and the scarves you could be.
Well, the nice thing is you can layer in Southern California in like October, November, December. But the nice, you know, also by like 1 p.m. you're like, oh, I can take all these.
I don't know if you can
off.
Turtleneck though.
I'm not a turtleneck guy. I have a very very sensitive. I'm a big flannel guy, but I hate. Turtlenecks, not my.
He has a sensitive neck, everyone.
I have a very sensitive neck because I'm just a sensitive boy. This was so fun, Angela.
Thank you, Liam.
That's it.
That's it.
Any parting words?
That was such a weird tone.
Hey, wait,
can
I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question before we wrap up? That you've, I don't think you've ever been asked this on the podcast, but maybe I'm wrong. What lights you up lately, Angela?
Oh my God, what lights me up? Truly, I know I spoke about the wine bottling, but being with a crew of people who are passionate about something and being in a team, like the day I got to be part of that team and we all had our roles and things, like shit was going to go really badly if everyone didn't concentrate and get it together. And there was something so fun about that experience. You know, we had a schedule to get through, and like Byron's a dad and he needed to go at 3:30 to like pick up his kid, but it meant we had to bottle all this wine, and that really lit me up. Also, there's something fabulous about concentrating on a task like that's physical, and I found that if I let my mind wander, I would make a mistake. Collecting all these bottles. So it was a really good lesson.
Out of your body experience.
Yeah, in focus, like being focused, being part of a team, and having a beautiful product to look at the end of it and feeling a sense of accomplishment. That really lit me up. Now we just have to, now there's a new stage to people drinking this wine and enjoying it. So that's for the moment.
That's a great answer. I can't wait to try the wine when it is available to the world. Well, I guess you'll tell us all about that when that happens.
I will tell you all about it. But it's
Do you have a name for it yet?
Yeah, it's called Old Sound Vineyard. And we live on Old Sound Road in Matatuck, where our, you know, vineyard is and these acres of grapes. Vineyard sounds very grandiose. It's a few acres of grapes, which is very different than what's out on the North Fork, but we've made it our own.
Well, that's lovely. Makes me want to come back. It makes me want to be back in New York and the
We'll
East
have
Coast.
A wedding eventually, a big party.
On the North
out
Fork?
Out here. Yeah, out here.
Very cool.
So you can visit Old Sound.
I'd love to. All right, now we have to stop because this is just ridiculous. Okay,
bye,
thanks
everyone.
Everybody. Bye.
Boop. Lit Up is a podcast from Sugar 23. It's hosted by me, Angela Ledgerwood, and is produced by Liam Billingham. Mike Mayer and Michael Sugar are the executive producers. The theme music is by Andre Radovsky. Until next time, bye everyone.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Vim, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.